It's an honor for our family to be sponsoring a weekend of Shiurim, which began last night with the Feldman family. And this morning we'll have the pleasure of hearing Rabbi Daniel Feldman, who is really, as Rabbi Vail alluded to, is an Eloi. And as he also said, Miksach Shvacho Befanav, so I'll leave it at that, but he's a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva University. I have here are two of the books he's written in English. These are fascinating books. Mitzvot Bein Adam L'Chaverot, The Right and the Good, Halacha and Human Relations, Divine Footsteps, Chesed and the Jewish Soul. They're really excellent halachic analysis of all kinds of mitzvot ben adam l'chaviro. He's written a collection of svarim in Hebrew, Bina b'svarim, which I have in my library at home, which I haven't read as much of, I must say. And he is the rabbi in Teaneck, New Jersey, and he's here with his wife and four kids, and it's a pleasure to have him here this morning, and over Shabbat we'll hear him too, but v'akasha. Rav Daniel, who will be speaking on embarrassing people in public, the prohibition of embarrassing people in public.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Rabbi Kelman, for the too generous introduction. I won't make any comments about the connection between the introduction and the topic. Just start off with a little bit of a story. And it's a story which I think is particularly appropriate if we gather together to commemorate the memory of people who have devoted their lives and their energies to Harbatzas HaTorah, to spreading Torah, and to teaching Torah. So it's a topic that's relevant, that there was a question that was once posed to one of the great Marbitzei Torah of the past century, to someone who did a tremendous amount to bring Torah to America in many different forms, Rav Aaron Cutler, the founder of the Lakewood Yeshiva. And he was asked a question about the way God arranges the spreading of Torah. It doesn't seem like it makes sense. It doesn't seem like it would seem to fit what we would think that God would want. That here we have the idea, the belief that God is interested in Torah learning taking place. And yet, when you have people who are devoted to learning Torah, people who are talented in a way in which they can accomplish a lot in learning Torah, people who are apparently cut out for that type of pursuit, so much so that they become prominent Rosh Yeshiva. So what happens? At that point, they begin taking on the responsibility of raising money for their yeshiva. So then they have to go and travel around the world raising money, and they can't spend any more time learning Torah. So why would God want that? Why would HaKadosh Baruch Hu set up the world in such a way that the people who seem most appropriate to devote their lives to learning Torah are no longer able to do so? They have to wander around the world raising money to support their yeshiva. So the way I heard the story at first, Rav Aaron Cutler responded with three possible answers, three possible suggestions as to why he thought God would set up the world in such a way that that's how things play out. The first answer he gave is that this increases the spreading of Torah, that because the Rosh Yeshiva are forced to travel in order to raise money, so therefore they have to give shiurim in different places, and therefore their Torah is spread much farther than it ever would have been otherwise. If they didn't have any pressure to support the yeshiva, they would have sat in their own dalarama, so to speak, in their own building forever, never meeting anyone else. But because they travel the world, because they go from community to community, so there is much more of a spreading of the Torah that they have to give, which relates to the second answer. The second answer, I don't know what it was. I never heard what the second answer that he gave, so I figure if I tell the story in different places, maybe somebody in the audience will know what the second answer is, and maybe I'll find out what the second answer was. But the third answer is the answer that I'm interested in today. And if anybody knows the second answer, please feel free to provide it at any point. But the third answer is relevant to what I'd like to speak about. And it seems like a creative, perhaps cutesy approach, and we'll talk about whether or not that's what it is, or is there something perhaps even more profound than it seems. So Rav Kotler pointed to a halacha in the Torah that we find a number of times. We'll read about it again a little bit later in the summer. That there is a concept in the Torah called the ir miklat. Now we know that if, God forbid, somebody is killed, b'shogeg, somebody is inadvertently killed, it refers to a situation where it wasn't an intentional murder, but it wasn't completely blameless either. So the one who kills somebody else carelessly, b'shogeg, inadvertently, so what the Torah prescribes for such a person is exile. He has to be sent away from his place. He has to go to the city of refuge, to this ir miklat. So says Rav Aaron Kotler, we know that the Talmud says that if somebody embarrasses somebody else, it's compared to killing them. And when you have somebody who is a teacher, when you have somebody who's in the position of a rabbi, so occasionally it's going to happen that they're going to embarrass a student. They're not going to do it on purpose. They're not mean. But it's going to happen from time to time that inadvertently, b'shogeg, a teacher is going to embarrass a student. And if the punishment for inadvertently killing someone is gullus, and if embarrassing somebody is considered to be like killing them, so therefore it makes sense the Rashi Yeshiva have to be exiled, they have to go wandering around in gullus in order to atone for inadvertently embarrassing students. So it seems like a cute approach. I think there is something a little bit more to be said about what he's getting at, and I'd like to return to that topic. But first, it's an entree a little bit to consider that question. What exactly do we mean when we say the Talmud does make this comparison? What exactly is going on when we note that the Talmud does seem to link the two? That embarrassing people and murder are placed next to each other, are compared by the Talmud. What exactly is going on with that? So this begins with a passage the Gemara has in Maseches Bava Metzia, the end of the fourth parak on Daf Nun Ches and Daf Nun Tes, where the Gemara talks about a number of statements that very powerfully make this point, that there are tremendous prohibitions involved with embarrassing people in public. First, the Gemara tells us about King David, about David HaMelech. That David HaMelech, as we all know, had an episode in his past that he had moved beyond the episode with Bathsheba, and he had done tshuva, according to the Navi, and yet the Gemara tells us that people continuously tried to embarrass him about this episode. And they would say he'd be giving a shiur about whatever it is, Hilchos Shabbos, whatever he'd be talking about, and somebody would raise his hand in the middle of the shiur and say, "Yes, King, I have a question. Fred Smith, National Enquirer, tell me, it's a fascinating shiur you're giving about psikreishlo d'lichale. What the punishment do you get for being involved with a possibly married woman?" So the king responded, "That's a good question. Somebody who does that is executed. But after that, he has a portion in the next world. He has a chelek ba'olam haba. But somebody who embarrasses people in public has no chelek in olam haba, has no portion in the next world." Apparently making the point that what this person was doing was worse than what he was bringing up about David HaMelech. And therefore the Gemara says, apparently we can derive from here, that it's preferable for someone to be involved with a possibly married woman rather than embarrass someone in public. Now that line you don't really find in the halachic codes. It's not brought in the practical halachic works, which perhaps is not so surprising. It's not really a situation that really presents itself so much. But there is another discussion the Talmud then goes on to have, which is perhaps a little more relevant, also extreme, but at least a little more conceivable. The Talmud talks about the trial of Tamar. Tamar, we know from the Chumash, was pregnant, and Yehuda was accusing her of being involved with someone outside the family, even though she was committed to the family because of the laws of Yibum. And he didn't realize that he was the father. So Tamar chose to give him the opportunity to come forward on his own rather than identifying him against his will. And the risk was that if she didn't do this, he might not come forward and she would have been executed. And it sounds like from the Chumash that she was willing to let that happen, that she was willing to let herself be executed if Yehuda didn't come forward on his own and identify himself. Very surprising, shocking story on many, many levels, and we don't really have the ability right now to go into all of the questions that can be asked about this, but the Talmud says, based on that episode, Noach lo li adam, apparently it's preferable for a person, sheyapil atzmo lekivshon shalesh, that he should let himself be thrown into a fiery furnace. That was what was waiting for Tamar. V'al yal ben p'nei chaver b'rabim, rather than embarrass somebody else in public. A very difficult idea on so many levels. The commentaries on Chumash have a hard time figuring out what's going on, because even if we say this is a general principle, it's surprising enough. But to say that somebody who's on trial is not allowed to defend themselves by saying who the real culprit is not really conceivable. So that's a whole discussion a little bit outside of our scope. But for now, the Talmud is we're interested in that statement of the Talmud that makes this comparison, that apparently it's better to let oneself be executed rather than embarrass someone in public. So what in the world is going on there? So it seems that, as the Talmud continues to discuss, that what's the operative element here is that there is some comparison, as we mentioned before, being drawn between humiliating people and killing them. The Gemara notes a physiological clue that you call killing shvichas damim, spilling of blood, and somebody who is embarrassed, their blood spills internally, their blood drains. Okay, but that's presumably just a remez, so to speak, that's a clue to the idea of the psychic pain that is relevant, that a person who is humiliated goes through such a profound internal suffering that apparently the Talmud is saying that it could conceivably be comparable to death. Now, this may not be a concept that we ever go through in our own lives, hopefully, but it is an idea that we do find throughout history, that there are individuals who have chosen death rather than humiliation, whether it means suicide, whether it means something along those lines. The idea that a type of humiliation in the extreme can be experienced as worse than death by some is supported by some examples in history. So apparently this is what the Talmud is getting at, that the pain of humiliation can be so painful that it can be comparable to being killed. So the question that we need to try to discuss a little bit is the Talmud really making some type of a literal comparison? Is it really saying that we will follow this through for all intents and purposes and will say that whatever strictures we put upon avoiding murder, avoiding killing people, we will apply also to avoiding humiliating them? And that seems to be the operative element that the Talmud is dealing with here when it seems to suggest that there is a rule of Yehareg Val Yavor. And we know the Talmud says that for most of the mitzvahs in the Torah, if somebody puts a gun to your head and says, eat non-kosher food or violate the Shabbos, so the rule is Yavor Val Yehareg, you should commit the transgression rather than be killed. But there are three exceptions. If somebody says, kill that person or I'll kill you, so you have to let them kill you. If somebody says, worship idols, engage in adultery, the three basic exclusions, the three Yehareg Val Yavor, is a very short list. So is the Talmud telling us here there is a fourth item on the list? And apparently also, if somebody says, humiliate that person or I'll kill you, you have to say, no, I can't, I'm sorry. The prohibition of humiliating people is Yehareg Val Yavor. Is that what's going on here? Hard to say. It's a surprising idea. The first thing we'll say about this topic is do not try this at home. This is not something, in case you leave now, shouldn't leave here thinking that you should give up your life rather than embarrass people. But it is very striking that it's a topic that is at least entertained. It's a topic that does seem to be the simple reading of this passage in the Talmud. And there was a debate among the Rishonim whether to take it literally or not. On the one hand, we have a group of Rishonim that do seem to take it literally. Most explicitly in this camp is Rabbeinu Yonah. Rabbeinu Yonah, the great ethicist and moralist and Rishon, in his Sefer Shari Tshuva, does seem to take this position that this is a literal, actual ruling of the Talmud, that this is in a category of Yehareg Val Yavor, apparently understanding the comparison to be literal, to be genuine, that it's actually equal to murder. There could be a number of other Rishonim who are in this camp. Also, a little bit less explicitly, there's much discussion about Tosfos. Tosfos on the side of the page in the Talmud of Masechet Sota and Daf Yud, where this passage appears as well. So Tosfos there raises the question that if the Talmud elsewhere in Sanhedrin and Daf Ayin Dalet, the Talmud tells us a list of three averos, three transgressions, which are Yehareg Val Yavor. So how come this one isn't on the list? It shouldn't be three, it should be four. So the easy answer to give is, well, it's not on the list because it's not literal. The Talmud doesn't really mean it. That would be the easiest answer to give. Tosfos doesn't say that, leading the Brisker Rav and many others to say that the Tosfos is also in the camp with Rabbeinu Yonah that understands this is practical halacha. The difficulty with the Tosfos is that the second easiest answer to give is that it is on the list, because since murder is on the list, if this is a derivative of murder, so then we could say that it's already included. So Tosfos doesn't say that either. So Tosfos is a little hard to understand because it doesn't give either of the two easiest answers. So it's a whole discussion really where to put this Tosfos in terms of this discussion, but there were many who put it together with Rabbeinu Yonah that they do understand this passage literally. And there are many Rishonim who don't understand it literally. Most explicitly in this camp is the Me'iri. The Me'iri in a number of places in Brachos and Pesachim, where this passage also appears, the Me'iri says this is not a literal statement. This is Derech Tachos, Derech Azhara. It has different ways of saying that this is not really the literal intent of the Talmud. It's a way of making the point that this is a very severe prohibition. It's not one that is meant to be taken in absolute practical terms. Many assume this is also the view of the Rambam. The Rambam is not explicit on this, but the Rambam does rule that there are three averis which you have to give up your life for. He also rules against the view of other Rishonim, such as Tosfos and Avodah Zarah, that one is not permitted to voluntarily add to this list, to pick another aver and say, well, I'm going to give up my life for this one. And since he doesn't spell out that that's a requirement by humiliation, so many understand the Rambam does not feel there is even the permissibility of giving up your life for this. So that's how many assume within the Rambam, but that's some discussion. So most explicitly, it's really Rabbeinu Yonah on one side and the Me'iri on the other side, and other Rishonim as a topic of analysis, how to figure out what camp they belong in. But again, practical terms will say, do not try this at home. But it's very striking that it's a topic that was entertained by the Rishonim and the later Achronim as well. I saw an article once was printed in one of the rabbinical journals, I think it was in Hamar, which is probably a very interesting path to this question, where he suggests the author, I believe the name of the author was Rabbi Pinchas Levinson, wanted to suggest the following approach, which is very powerful. That perhaps the language, the Talmud, noach lo liadam, the Talmud is trying to say that in theory it could be the case that it would be preferable to die rather than to embarrass somebody else. However, in practical terms, we could never ever put that into play. We could never act on that practically, because you never know in advance how any situation of humiliation is ever going to play out. There are so many variables, both in terms of the individual being humiliated and in terms of how the reaction. Sometimes things blow over very quickly, and sometimes things last much longer than anyone expected. You can never tell in advance how anything like this is ever going to play out. So there's no way to know that we're dealing with that situation. Obviously, we're not talking about a minor embarrassment. If somebody spills some ketchup on his shirt, we're not going to say he'd rather die than have the ketchup spilled on his shirt. There's minor embarrassment and there's major embarrassment. So clearly, we're only talking about a deep, extreme, mortifying humiliation where this discussion even takes off. And we never know when that's going to be the case. We never know in advance. So we're certainly very careful to avoid bringing that about when we don't have our lives at stake. But to say that we would take such an extreme measure as put our lives at risk in order to avoid it, so that we're not ready to say in practical terms. But the theory is very important, because most of the situations that we have, we don't have to risk our lives in order to avoid embarrassing someone. So certainly, without that pressure, it's not much of a question. But it's also fascinating to note some of the other ways in which halachic discussions do build on this comparison, do build on this possible relationship. One is the view of the Chachma Shlomo. The Chachma Shlomo was Rav Shlomo Kluger, who was a great postlik, the author of many volumes of Tshuvas and a commentary to the Shulchan Aruch by that name. And Rav Shlomo Kluger has a ruling which nobody agreed with. All the later generations they argued on, there's a lot of discussion about, but it's also fascinating for what it represents potentially. Should just mention he had a different way of getting to this conclusion. He had a whole different lumdus to get to this point, but it relates to this discussion as well. He discusses the following point. He says, let's say you are walking past a river and you hear somebody's drowning and you're a strong swimmer. So you have an obligation to jump in and save them. The Torah says, Lo Samar al Damriacha, you can't stand by when somebody's life is at risk. But let's say you're not such a strong swimmer. So you know if you jump in the river, so maybe you'll be able to push this person to safety, but you're for sure going to drown. So you're not obligated, you're probably not even permitted to give up your life in order to save somebody else's life. You can maybe risk your life, that was a discussion, but to give up your life, you're not permitted to do. So Reb Shlomo Kluger went a step further, and he said, let's say if the only way you could save this person's life is by humiliating yourself, you're not obligated to do it. Now again, he had a different way of getting to this conclusion, but it seems like he's also taking a literalist view of this idea that if you're not obligated to die for this, so you're not obligated to be humiliated for this either. Humiliation is equal to death. So again, the later Sfarim did not agree with this. There's a discussion about this in the Sefer Kli Chemda and Chumash. Diane Grossness from London in his Tshuva Slave Aryeh has a whole Tshuva against this. And Reb Zalman Nechemiah Goldberg has a number of essays where he published where he argued on this Chachma Shlomo. And even more notably, his distinguished father-in-law, Reb Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, in one of his Tshuvas in the Mincha Shlomo, also takes issue with this ruling of the Chachma Shlomo. But it's interesting to note that Reb Shlomo Zalman, in that Tshuva where he discusses this, it's not necessarily the case that Reb Shlomo Zalman completely rejects a literal view of the Gemara. He necessarily disagrees that Talmud is making a genuine comparison. Because he raises another question. Reb Shlomo Zalman asks the following, that if we do assume that humiliation is equal to death, so we know the rule is, let's say it's Shabbos, and somebody, Chas V'Shalom, has a heart attack, something like that, somebody needs emergency medical attention. So what are we going to do? So we'll do whatever we need to do in order to save a life. We'll call the ambulance, we'll drive to the hospital, do whatever it is. So let's say you know that somebody's about to be humiliated on Shabbos. So shouldn't we say as well, that's also a situation of pikuach nefesh, that if humiliation is like death, so if we'll be mechal Shabbos to save somebody from being killed, we should be mechal Shabbos also to save somebody from being humiliated. So Reb Shlomo Zalman very strikingly says, he's not sure what the answer to that question is. He's not ready to say that halacha l'maisa we should do that. He says, unless it's a din d'rabbanan, if it's a rabbinical prohibition, so we already have a statement that Talmud says in a number of places as well, first of all in Maseches Brachos, that there is a rule, gadol kavod abrios, that kavod abrios, human dignity, is such a powerful principle that can push away dinim derabbanan, can push away rabbinical laws. So if it was a rabbinical law, that he's willing to say. But if it was a chilul Shabbos daraisa, so he's not ready to say that. There was a lesser known posek, the Tshuva Shemi Shimon, who's written by Rav Shimon Pollack. He has a tshuva where he does take that position. He says that he would go so far. But Rav Shlomo Zalman was not ready to necessarily go that far, but he's not sure why not. He's not sure intellectually why we wouldn't draw that comparison and say that you should be Mechal Shabbos in order to avoid humiliating somebody. So there is a discussion in some of the later Sfarim. Shlomo Zalman wasn't so long ago, but there's Sfarim written after him too. So the discussion, some suggest various approaches. One could say the same approach we mentioned a few minutes ago is probably relevant here as well. That maybe in theory it could be true, that if you really knew that somebody was going to endure a humiliation of the level that could make them suicidal, for example, then yes, we would say that you should be Mechal Shabbos for that. But we can rarely know, if ever, beforehand, that we're dealing with that type of a situation. Again, the variables are so great, so as a matter of policy, no one's going to really advocate this because it doesn't really fit in. The same way we wouldn't advocate martyrdom, so we're not going to advocate Chilul Shabbos either. But again, in theory, the discussion perhaps does resonate on some level, and it's worth keeping in mind and noting the fact that this is something that was entertained. It's also interesting to note that there is another discussion about this. There is a statement the Talmud has in the end of Maseches Brachos that we have an obligation, really an obligation every day of Berachos Kohanim. In Chutz Laaretz, the common practice is not to do Berachos Kohanim every day. The common practice is to do it only on Yontif. A whole discussion why that is, also not for now. But this practice of Berachos Kohanim, so the Gemara says there is an exclusion. Not every Kohen is qualified to do Berachos Kohanim. And excluded from Berachos Kohanim is a Kohen who is a murderer. Kohen Shaharag es HaNefesh, if a Kohen killed somebody, so then he's not allowed to do Berachos Kohanim. The Gemara darshens a pasuk in Sefer Yeshaya, Yideichem Damam Aleihu, that your hands are filled with blood, and these hands cannot be used for Berachos Kohanim, for the duchening, which involves, also known as nesias kapayim, lifting up your hands, hands that have killed somebody, are not appropriate for such a mitzvah. So there's a whole literature, which is also outside of our scope, discussion of, are we only talking about murderers, or are we talking about anybody who has killed somebody, perhaps even inadvertently, or maybe even justifiably? What if you killed somebody in self-defense, if you killed somebody in war? So there's an extensive literature about this. Rav Moshe Feinstein and many others have long discussions about this. You could hear it either way, because on the one hand, you could hear it as being a concept about murder specifically and excluding justifiable homicide. On the other hand, we know that David HaMelech was excluded from building the Beit HaMikdash, even though the people he killed in the context of war. Nonetheless, God says it's not the right atmosphere, so to speak, for building the Beit HaMikdash. So we could imagine Birkas Kohanim might have the same policy as well. So that's a discussion of the whole literature outside of our scope. But what's in our scope is a tshuva. There's a number of poskim who discuss, what if you have a Kohen who humiliates people, who goes around embarrassing people? Should we say that such a Kohen is comparable to a murderer, and therefore he shouldn't duchen as well? This is discussed by a few contemporary poskim. Rav Nassim Gishtetner, Zechon Levracha, was a great postig from Bnei Brak, who passed away a few months ago. And Yibad L'Chaim Rav Vosner and the Shuvah Shevet Halevi have discussions about this, that should we say that somebody who, a Kohen who humiliates people, should be excluded from Berchas Kohanim? So those two great poskim are not ready to go that far. They have a whole discussion, but they think, practically speaking, we're not going to actually draw the comparison in such powerful terms. Rav Gishtetner has a discussion there also, where he says that even if you want to say that it was absolutely literal, even if you want to say it was a complete connection, still the Gemara specifically talks about bloody hands as a reference to physical murder. So if you murder somebody not physically, so then that's not going to be included. There happens to be a literature also about somebody uses the Shem HaMeforish. You know, the Chazal tell us that's how Moshe killed the Mitzri, with using God's name. So maybe it's an indirect, non-physical type of killing. Would that also be included? But in any event, that's what Rav Gishtetner writes, that this is not physical. So even if it was actual equation, if it's not physical, it's not going to be a part of the list. So those two great poskim felt that we wouldn't go that far with the comparison. But it's interesting to note there were others who did entertain it a little bit more. There are a number of contemporary Sfarim on Hilchos Berachos Kohanim. If you look through them, you find some of them do take this position, that at least consider it. There's at least one Sefer which did take this conclusion, that a Kohen who embarrasses people is not qualified to duchen, is part of the exclusion of a Rotzeach. A very striking idea. Those are some of the points that are raised in terms of the practical ramifications of this comparison. What about philosophical ramifications? How exactly do we find this having an impact just in areas that are a little bit less practical? So it's interesting, if we go back to the passage in the Talmud that we started with. So we saw that David HaMelech, when he responded to the heckler, when he responded to the reporter who asked him about his past, so he said that somebody who embarrasses people in public has no chelek in olam haba, has no portion in the next world. So where do we get that from? So you'll say, it's a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Yes, it is a Mishnah in Pirkei Avos. Where did the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos get it from? So that was the whole discussion. There is a whole analysis as to what exactly prompts the Mishnah to tell us this rule, that somebody who embarrasses people has no chelek in olam haba. And there are a number of approaches. And two of the approaches, it's interesting, it's what we call in the Beis Medrash, so l'shitaso, when you find that the Rishon says something here, and then he says something here, and you realize it's working off the same principle, it's consistent because it works off the same understanding, so we call that a l'shitaso. So you find in this discussion that the Rabbeinu Yonah and the Rambam are l'shitasam on this point, that they are agreeing with themselves. Because when we started off, so we mentioned the whole question of martyrdom, of the Yehari Valyavor, and we saw that Rabbeinu Yonah seems to say that it is literal, that there is an obligation of Mesiras Nefesh, of giving up your life. And the Rambam says, apparently the Rambam seems to hold, that that's not the case, that there is no such obligation. So it could be that they are paralleling their views when they consider this question of, why does the Mishnah say that there's no chelek in olam haba, there's no reward in the next world for somebody who humiliates people. So Rabbeinu Yonah, who has a literalist understanding, so Rabbeinu Yonah says that's what's going on here as well. Why is there no chelek in olam haba? Because the person is a murderer, the person is killing somebody, so therefore that's his punishment, he has no portion in the next world.
But you'll say, wait a minute, Rabbeinu Yonah, it doesn't say that in the Gemara. It doesn't say anywhere in the Talmud that a murderer has no portion in the next world. So Rabbeinu Yonah says, you're right, he's worse than a murderer. Why is he worse? He's worse because he's just as bad. But a murderer is going to realize he did something terrible. It's going to be a huge scandal. It's going to be a trial. He's going to go to jail. It's going to be a whole story. So eventually he's going to repent. Eventually he'll do tshuva. And then he'll be punished in this world, but not in the next world. But somebody who humiliates people is doing something just as bad. And he's never going to repent. He's not going to realize that he did anything of consequence. He's not going to ever fully appreciate the degree to which he committed a transgression of equal nature, and therefore he'll be left with the original theoretical punishment of the murderer. That's how Rabbeinu Yonah understands, apparently, the Shitasa. This he writes in his commentary to Pirkei Avos, but it seems to be essentially compatible with his view in Shaarei Tshuva. The Rambam is also a parallel to Shitasa, because the Rambam has a statement in his commentary to the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, where he understands a little bit differently. And we saw before, the Rambam, we seem to believe, holds the comparison is not literal, that one is not obligated to give up his life for this. So that's consistent with the way he understands this concept as well. The Rambam, in the beginning of the last parak of Sanhedrin, the Rambam says, why is it that people like those who embarrass others in public have no chelek in Olam Haba? So he explains it as part of a broader picture. He says, somebody who regularly embarrasses people in public, somebody who does this habitually, so that's an indication that they're probably in a very specific halachic category known as a jerk. A person who does this consistently, so then you can probably guess they're presumably not on the list. That when they get to Shemayim, they're not going to, the rest of their resume of their lives is probably not going to be a Ben Olam Haba. In other words, he's saying it's not a one-to-one correlation that you do this transgression once you're kicked out. It's not that it's an act like murder. It's an indication of a low character, and somebody who does this habitually is presumably not a Ben Olam Haba. That's how he understands, again, consistent with the view that he doesn't necessarily see it as equal to killing. That being the case, there is a third view that some of the later Sfarim suggest, and that helps us to perhaps get a little more perspective on what's going on. There are those who suggest that maybe the punishment is really midah keneged midah, is really proportionate, really makes sense, because we have a basic idea that the notion of a chelek in Olam Haba, the idea that one has a reward in the world to come, is connected inextricably with the idea of an eternal soul. If you have an eternal soul, so then you have that which can appreciate the world to come. What is the source of an eternal soul? It is the pasuk in the Torah that says God created all of humanity, B'Tselem Elokim, in His image. So because we have this divine spark, we're created in the image of God, so therefore there is this notion that there is a soul that can enjoy an Olam Haba. But the idea of B'Tselem Elokim, the divine image, is also the source for something else. It's also the source for the idea of human dignity. So therefore, some Sfarim suggest that if you're making a statement you don't believe in human dignity, you think you can humiliate people, it's not a problem. So essentially, that's a denial of the idea of the Tzelem Elokim. And therefore, it's a proportionate punishment that, okay, so you're not going to benefit from the Tzelem Elokim, you don't have an eternal soul for Olam Haba purposes. So that idea that there is a denial of the Tzelem Elokim, a denial of the human dignity of the individual, it's a very striking idea and may help us to get to our last phase of our discussion here. This whole time we've been using an expression, Halbanas Pnei Chavero Barabim, or we've been alluding to an expression, that's what the Talmud used, I don't know how many times we said it, but the Talmud has this expression, Halbanas Pnei Chavero Barabim, you are whitening someone's face in public. Now, you could ask a number of questions on that. First of all, the first word, halbanas, whitening, that's not the word we would have chosen. Right? If somebody gets embarrassed, we normally understand the face turns red, they blush. Why does it say whitening? So there are those texts that actually change the text. Some say it should be madin, you do find that a little bit, but that's very rare. Most of the texts do say whitening. So some of the Sfarim explain that what happens, the Tosfos Yontif, others explain that what's happening is that when a person really gets deeply humiliated, so first they blush, the blood rushes to the face, and then it drains, what we call blanching. They turn stark white, so that reflects a really deep level of humiliation. Okay, so that's the first word. But what about the last word? Halbanas pnei chavero berabim, in public. So you could ask a number of questions. What does that mean in public? And is that a necessary condition? Are we saying that this only applies when somebody's embarrassed in public? Or does it apply even if they're embarrassed in private? So there's discussions about both of that, to take one at a time. So first of all, the question of what is public. So most of the Svarim explain that public, it doesn't require 100 people. It doesn't require a minyan either. Sometimes for halachic purposes, we find that 10 counts as a minyan. A minyan is what's necessary to publicize something. Most of the postmen agree that's not the case here, but rather 3 people are enough. It's an expression that's borrowed from Hilchos Lashon Hara. We have an idea of Ape Tzlasa. The Talmud says in Bava Basra in the 3rd parak, if you want to know what it takes to make something public, if 3 people know about it, so we say Chavra Chavra Islay, the Chavra the Chavra Islay, your friend has a friend, and your friend's friend has a friend, and your friend's friend has a cousin, who has a brother, who has an uncle, who has a hairdresser, who has a dog walker, who knows somebody else. Eventually, if 3 people know, so the whole world knows, everyone's going to find out. So most of the poskim understand that that's what we're talking about. We're talking about 3. And 3 includes the embarrassor and the embarrassee. So essentially we mean one witness. If there's one witness, so that's called public. Okay. But still, that one witness, is that necessary? Does it have to be in public, or does it apply even without the witness? So that is a whole discussion. It's probably a debate among the Rishonim. And there are those who suggest kind of an interesting compromise. There are those who maintain that maybe if you embarrass somebody in private, so then that's a prohibition. That's wrong. If you embarrass somebody in public, that's when you have the whole discussion we've been having. That's Ein Lo Chelek L'Olam Haba, and there is a possible Yehar V'Yav, or everything we've been talking about till now, that only applies in public. And in private, that's a prohibition. So how are we splitting the difference here? How are we just making a compromise? How exactly did you get to such a conclusion? I think you get to such a conclusion as follows. So this whole time we've been talking about the title of the topic was the prohibitions of embarrassing people in public. So what are the prohibitions? We haven't identified them. Where does it say in the Torah that you're not allowed to embarrass people? So the truth is it says it probably in 2 places. This is the Tashbetz in his commentary to Pirkei Avos, as you know, it's really 2 separate prohibitions. On the one hand, so there is a prohibition in Parshas Bahar we read a few weeks ago. It's a prohibition called onah, that a person is not allowed to oppress someone else, which the Talmud has the whole discussion applies in the marketplace. If you're price gouging, if you're overcharging by a large degree, that's called onah. And the Mishnah, the last Mishnah in Hazav, says, and this is what leads into the discussion that we started with, the whole discussion about David HaMelech and Tamar, comes off of a Mishnah in the end of the 4th parak above Messiah, which says, Kishem Sheyesh onah b'mamon, that just like there is onah in the monetary realm, so too there is onah, there is oppression, there is affliction in the emotional realm. But if you're going to cause somebody emotional suffering, so then that's a prohibition of onah's dvar. And there are many examples. The famous example the Mishnah has, if you go into a store and you ask somebody how much something costs and you have no intent of buying it, so that's causing him emotional pain. There's a whole literature about why that is exactly. If you remind somebody of their past in a way that causes them pain, somebody has repented and moved on. And you say, hey, remember when you were in jail all those years, all the terrible stuff you did? So that's also considered to be onas devarim. And certainly embarrassing somebody in public is a very big example of onas devarim. That is something which is a very significant reflection of this prohibition. On the other hand, there's another separate pasuk. This we read a few weeks before that in Parshas Kedoshim. So the Torah tells us that there is a obligation if somebody is doing something wrong. So there's a mitzvah in the Torah, hochech tochech semisecha, is an obligation of tochecha, that you have to rebuke somebody who's doing the wrong thing. Somebody who's committing a transgression, so you're supposed to stop them, you're supposed to rebuke them. So the Talmud says, in the middle of Maseches Erechin, the Talmud says, Yachol afilu yishtanes panav, that maybe I should do this, even if as a consequence of doing this, their face is going to change color, they're going to be humiliated, maybe I should do it anyway. So the Talmud says, no, look at the rest of the Pasuk. What does the Pasuk continue? V'losisa alav chet, you shall not endure a transgression, a sin, because of him. So apparently Talmud is just saying, how are you going to get a transgression because of this tochecha? Because if you do it in such a way that humiliates the person, so you're going to get in trouble. So you're trying to stop him from sinning, but if you're going to humiliate him in the process, so then you will be committing a transgression yourself. So apparently what you see here is the Talmud is using, the Torah is using a style, you find a couple of places in the Torah, where it gives a prohibition in the extreme, And you can infer from there that in the less extreme cases, it also applies, the way the Rambam explains this idea. That here, you might think that, okay, I have a mitzvah to say something. So then, even in that context, I'm not allowed to do it in a humiliating way. So kal v'chomer, for sure, if it's a situation where I don't have a mitzvah to say something, for sure I'm not allowed to do it. It's a style you find throughout the Torah. Now, for example, we have a prohibition of hitting people. How do you know you're not allowed to hit somebody? Because the Torah says that when somebody is in Beis Din, is getting malchus, is getting whipped for committing a transgression, so the Torah says, arboy miyakenu lo yosef, you're not allowed to hit anymore. So in other words, the Torah is telling that even when you're obligated to hit somebody, you can't go one strike beyond. That's a transgression. So for sure, if you're not obligated in the first place, you can't hit somebody. So to here, you're not allowed to humiliate someone even in the context of a mitzvah of Talchucha. So kal v'chomer, all the more so. So it seems to be we have really two distinct prohibitions here. We have on the one hand the prohibition of hurting someone's feelings, and we have a prohibition of taking away their dignity of making their face change color, which is relevant more in a public setting. And you could have one without the other. These are really two separate ideas. And perhaps what these, so to speak, compromised views are saying is essentially that if you embarrass somebody in private, that's a violation of the Isser in the Torah of Anos Dvar. And that's bad. That's a transgression. If you embarrass somebody in public, so then that's far worse. That's striking at the Tzelem Elokim. That's taking away their dignity. That's a much bigger deal. And that's where we have all of this discussion that potentially gives us all of this very significant weight to it. Which is not to say that Anos Dvarim by itself is a small matter. Anos Dvarim by itself is also a very serious matter. One of the Rishonim, the Mordechai, was of the opinion that there is a punishment of Malchus. We just talked a minute ago about giving a lashes. The Mordechai was of the opinion that this is a violation of the Torah that's subject to lashes. The later commentaries, the Knesset Gedolah and others, it can't be because we normally have a rule that alav shein bo maisa, if there's no action, so then it's not punishable by Malchus. The whole discussion of what exactly the Mordechai meant. But nonetheless, the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch both do say that a Beis Din is empowered to do what's necessary in order to enforce this. That a Beis Din should impose whatever penalties, a fascinating tshuva and nechsam sofer about this, and there's a whole literature about this, that a Beis Din is obligated to do what they have to. The Shulchan Aruch brings this twice in order to enforce the prohibition of Anos Dvarim, that people should not take others' dignity and others' emotional well-being lightly, and they have to be careful not to violate this prohibition. And if they do it in public, so then we have this much more serious consequence of Halbanos Pnei Chaver B'Rabim, which strikes away at the Tzelem Elokim. So before we'll close in a minute, before we maybe just quickly review some of those points, just want to come back to where we started. So what about Rav Aaron Cutler? So Rav Aaron Cutler had mentioned this idea that perhaps the Rosh Yeshiva go into exile, so to speak, that they have to wander the world because they embarrass people in public, because unintentionally, inadvertently, they'll say something that'll cause a student to feel embarrassment, and therefore it's a retzeach b'shogeg hizchayev galus. So is that just a cutesy response? Creative answers? I think he was getting at something a little deeper than that. I think he was getting at the following. And if we consider this idea, we'll read about it in a few weeks, this idea of retzeach b'shogeg, what exactly is that about? So somebody inadvertently kills somebody else, so they have to go into exile, and the relatives are allowed to chase them. The relatives are going to go after them otherwise. So what's that about? So it seems it's reflecting the following idea. What did this person do wrong? Right? He didn't intentionally kill anyone. He didn't have any violence in his heart. He didn't have any tain on anyone. The Torah spells out. He didn't hate anyone. He didn't have anything against anyone. His problem was he didn't worry enough about life. He didn't care enough about the sanctity of life in order to be careful that if he was conscious enough of the value of life and of the preciousness of humanity, so then he wouldn't be waving his axe around without looking who's behind him. He wouldn't be speeding through the red lights. He wouldn't be doing whatever he was doing that allowed somebody to be killed through his negligence. So this person's primary problem is that he was not focused enough on issues of life and death, was not worried enough about the preciousness of human existence, and therefore he made a tragic, fatal mistake. So what's the corrective? So now this person has to go into galus, he has to go into exile, and he has to always worry, maybe they're chasing after me. Maybe the relatives of this person are coming after me. I have to always look over my shoulder. So now, until now, I was never thinking about life and death. I was never worried about it. Now I have to worry about it constantly. Now I have to constantly be concerned. If I put one step out of this Ir Miklat, maybe the relative's going to hunt me down. Maybe I'm going to get killed. It's a complete shift in perspective, which is meant to offer a corrective to this original perspective that allowed him to make the mistake that he made also. So if you think about it also, so why would a Rebbe embarrass one of his students? Again, he's not doing it purposely. He's not trying to hurt anybody. He's not trying to cause anybody pain. Why would it happen? It could happen because a person is not really aware of the disparity between somebody who's an authority and somebody who's not an authority. You have a teacher in a classroom, so the teacher is essentially in control of the classroom, and the students are very submissive or very much in a subservient position. And they're not necessarily, the teacher is not necessarily always aware of this, not necessarily always conscious of the effect that their words have a much more powerful impact than they might otherwise have, and that they could say something which they think is innocent and which they could say to their friends and would have no problem, but could have a devastating impact on a student who's in a submissive position to them, who has to look to this authority figure with reverence and with submission. So what's the corrective? How do you address that? This Rosh Hashiva now has to go around the world, has to go to people's houses on their territory, say, could you please help me out? Could you give me a few dollars for the yeshiva? Could you support what I'm trying to do? If not, I'll have to go to the next person and ask him for help. And it's a complete opposite perspective. It's a complete shift in attitude, which perhaps creates a certain corrective, a certain balance that is perhaps offsetting whatever problems were there in the first place. So perhaps this is what Rav Aaron Cutler was getting at, that maybe on some level, this being taken out of that context allows a certain balance to the perspective that a teacher relationship sometimes creates and corrects these types of problems and allows for a more harmonious and more effective type of situation. There are a lot of challenges that are involved, even in the tremendous mitzvah of Harbatzas HaTorah, even when one is trying to do good. It's a lot of pitfalls or a lot of challenges, and it takes a certain type of sensitivity. It takes a certain type of attitude and balance and wisdom to be able to do it right, to be able to do it in an effective way. And I'll just say that I did not have the honor myself of knowing Rabbi Joseph and Ruth Kelman, but I do know their children, and if you're able to raise children who want to continue in that path of Harbatz HaTorah, it doesn't always happen that way. If you're able to raise children who will take it to the next level, so you can tell that the parents were doing something in a certain way, were doing something right, had a certain balance and a certain type of perspective, which is not always there. And it should be our bracha that we should always see that perspective, we should always be able to have that type of balance, so that we should be able to carry on this message effectively and bring it to the next level in a way that it's going to be heard in the way that it's meant to be heard. So maybe if you just indulge me for another minute, we'll just quickly review what we spoke about. We spoke about the fact that Talmud has this discussion. We mentioned Aaron Cutler's story, where he seemed to suggest that there is this comparison that a Rebbe goes into galus because he inadvertently embarrasses the students. And we talked about the Talmud's comparison between embarrassing and murder and killing people. We mentioned that some question whether it's literal or not. The Talmud tells a story about David HaMelech saying to his heckler that what you're doing to me is worse than what I had done. That's not brought in the Sifri Halacha, but the story of Tamar, that she was ready to sacrifice her life rather than embarrass people, so that some of the Sfarim do bring. The Rambam doesn't seem to bring it, and the Meiri says it's not literal, but Rabbeinu Yonah does seem to bring it. Tosfos, we saw with the whole discussion, maybe does see it literally. We emphasize, do not try this at home, but it is a discussion in the Poskim. We mentioned the suggestion that maybe, on the one hand, it's true, but practically speaking, we can never put it into practice because of the variables that are involved. And then we talked about how this is also applied in some other areas of halacha, mentioned from Shlomo Kluger's position, that one doesn't have to save somebody else's life if it's going to humiliate themselves. We mentioned that all the later Sfarim did not accept this, but it reflects a different approach, but also a certain literal reading to this idea. Reb Shlomo Zalman Orbach was one of those who didn't accept this, but did consider the question that maybe one should be Machal Shabbos in order to avoid humiliating someone. Was not ready to say that in the level of Minat Torah, even though the Tshuva Shem Yishimin did, but he did say it's true on a level of Midrabanan, and we suggested that maybe the previous answer could be used there as well, that in theory it might be true, but in practice, a matter of policy, we wouldn't do this. And then we talked also about the question of a Kohen, whether a Kohen who embarrasses people can duch, and we mentioned the position of the Shevet Halevi and the Lahoris Nassim that wouldn't take it that far, and a few others did take it that far. And then we discussed also the question of what does it mean when David HaMelech says there's no chelek in Olam Haba for somebody who embarrasses people. So where does he get that from? Besides the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos, who mentioned the Rambam and Rabbeinu Yonah Lushitasam, the Rabbeinu Yonah holds us actually equal to murder, so you get the same punishment as the murderer would have gotten had he not done tshuva, since he presumably won't do tshuva. And the Rambam, who doesn't seem to hold it as literal, but rather as indicative of qualities that will exclude somebody from Olam Haba. And then we mentioned the third approach, that there is a midah keneged midah. It's proportionate here because the tzelem elokim is what gives one a chelek in olam haba. It's also what gives one human dignity. So if you deny human dignity, maybe midah keneged midah, there's no chelek in olam haba. Which brought us to our discussion of what exactly the phrase halbanas panei chaveru barab means. We talked a little bit about why halbanas instead of ha'adamas. And maybe it's the later result of deep humiliation. And then what exactly does rabbin mean? We mentioned that most poskim agree that rabbin really does not mean 10, but means 3, including the party. So it means one witness, and that the discussion of whether rabbim is necessary or not, so there were some who had a compromise view that in private it's a prohibition and in public it's where you have all the consequences that we spoke about. And we suggested that was reflective of the fact that there are essentially two prohibitions here. There's a prohibition of onos devarim. Anytime you hurt somebody's feelings, that's prohibited. That's certainly relevant here. And there's another prohibition of lo sisa alav chait, that even in the context of where you're supposed to give somebody rebuke, you can't take it to the point where you're going to humiliate them. So all the more so if you don't have that mitzvah motivation, and that reflects a higher level, a deeper transgression. So perhaps there's a prohibition of onos devarim by itself, which is also a serious one. That a prohibition of hurting anyone's feelings, which the Mordechai felt was subject to Malkus, others thought that couldn't be. But the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, do write that a Bezdin does whatever it has to do in order to enforce this prohibition. And if it gets to a public point where there is humiliation, so then there is Lo Sisa Lav Chait, which has all of these deeper consequences. Again, many of them we emphasize do not try this at home, but does reflect the fact that there is a tremendous severity to this concept, which we have to try to be aware of. Certainly, because we're usually not dealing with life or death situations, so certainly there is a very relevant prohibition. And we talked about the tremendous balance that's necessary when dealing in the public sphere, when dealing with people in general, and that's what we see perhaps reflected in Rav Aaron's suggestion, that sometimes the Rebbe might sometimes lose perspective on how that imbalance can create a type of humiliation or emotional pain, and sometimes being taken out of that context is a corrective for that. So we should all be zocha, especially in the memory of the Marbitze Torah who we are commemorating today, that this balance should be a successful one, and we should be zocha to have much harbatzas haTorah with naches and with haslacha in all ways, and we should be zocha to future summers in which there is no mourning, in which there is only celebration. Thank you very much.
You understand what I mean when in my introduction, and really a pleasure to hear you and to have you. And we should all have, as you say, you know, bracha and simcha and yashar koach. For all the women in the room, I think that's not so many people, but the women's Beit Midrash is just starting now. My sister, Rav Daniel's sister, Rebecca, was also quite good. I don't think the men can go, but all right.
Okay, have a good show, sir.